From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the news from Iraq continues to be grim. U.S. Commander Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez says 3 to 6 American soldiers are being killed every week by attacks ever more lethal and sophisticated. Meanwhile, the mood of ordinary Iraqis is at least intermittently hostile. CNN reported that a crowd of angry, unemployed men threw rocks and set vehicles on fire Wednesday when they were turned away from a police station where they had hoped to apply for jobs. But is that a fair summary of the situation?
Last week, we talked to Congressman Jim Marshall, who had recently completed a 3-day tour of Iraq, and found that the coverage coming out of Baghdad was far more dismal than the reality he perceived on the ground. Dexter Filkins has been covering Iraq for the New York Times for the last 6 months. Right now, he's in Florida for a little R&R before heading back to Baghdad. He says that the criticism that good news is going unreported is unjust.
I get emails from time to time from people giving the same complaint. You know, why don't you write about this and why don't you write about that? And I remember one that stuck in my mind was, why don't you write about the fact that all 200 hospitals are open and running across Iraq? That's a wonderful, positive development. That's true. The hospitals are open. If you've been in a hospital in Iraq, however, the reality is far different. One should not picture a hospital in the United States. A typical hospital in Iraq is a nightmarish place where they don't have electricity, where there's people sleeping on the floors, where the emergency rooms at night are flooded with people who have been shot and maimed in the chaos that breaks out after curfew. And that's what I see. So it's just a more complicated picture.
So if you send a reporter to what is nominally a good news story, a reporter's instincts will be to find all that is not right and to report the story in full, not just the happy headline.
Exactly. I mean, part of the challenge that the media faces in Iraq is that the really intense and violent area of the country is the center part of the country, and it's the area around Baghdad, and that's where everyone is. It's where the seat of government is. It's where the Americans are headquartered. So most of the press tends to be there. That's where things are really, really bad. And so, frankly, you need to get out of there every now and then and see how the rest of the country is doing. This was a couple of months ago now, but I was in the southern part of the country in a town called Diwaniya, and that was being occupied by the American Marines. And it was so different from Baghdad that I was just floored. I got off a helicopter and, you know, the Marines and the locals were hugging each other and chatting and taking pictures together. And I remember I had walked into a little graduation ceremony of a medical school, and some of the Marines had taught classes there and helped administer the exams. And it was a completely different atmosphere. And literally, as I was driving back to Baghdad, the UN headquarters was car bombed, and I think, you know, 23 people had been killed. And so I actually wrote a story about that kind of the yin and the yang that you see every day there. And I think that does need to be reported. I mean, that even with all these terrible things going on, there's a lot of normalcy across Iraq.
One of the suggestions that Congressman Marshall had, and also former Pentagon spokesperson Tori Clark, who has gone to work for CNN this week, is the return of the embed program. They say that when reporters were traveling around with U.S. military units, that there was much more diversity of coverage and an opportunity to get out of Baghdad and see the bigger picture. Does that make any sense to you?
It seems to me that the real point they're trying to make is that the press isn't seeing things through the eyes of American soldiers anymore, and I don't think that's true. We have plenty of access to American soldiers.
I've read most of your stories coming from Iraq, and you know, I'd have to say that they express an overall pessimistic view of where things stand at this moment.
There's been a lot of progress made by the United States government in trying to set up a new government there, but it's an incredibly vast and complicated enterprise. I mean, maybe you have to go to Iraq and see how big the country is and how many areas of everyday life that the American military has to involve itself in to make this thing work. And it has to involve itself in areas that 19, 20-year-old soldiers have never been asked to do before. And they're doing the best they can, and they're a great bunch of guys. I think it's a very troubled enterprise, but it's still moving forward.
Well, then I have to ask you, is it possible that, at least in his observation, that the reporting doesn't quite track with what successes there have been. But Congressman Marshall's right?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think I've certainly tried to portray the American effort there in as accurate a way that I can, and that includes when they get things right. I think what is probably the most troubling single factor for the American effort there is the attitudes of the Iraqi people. And I can give you an example that I found absolutely chilling. I got a phone call on my satellite phone the other day from one of my Iraqi translators who said I was just near Fallujah, which is a town west of Baghdad. And he said, you know, get over here right away. Some guys have just set off a bomb and they blew up a truck. And I think one of the American soldiers has been killed. I drove over there very quickly and I found the scene where there was a truck that was on fire and it was unclear what had happened to the Americans. As it later turned out, he survived. But on both sides of the scene where the bomb had gone off, there were big crowds of Iraqis cheering what they thought was the death of an American soldier. They were cheering. And this was not, you know, al-Qaeda fanatics. I mean, these were parents with children. There were Iraqi police officers who'd been trained by the Americans cheering the what they thought was the death of an American soldier. When you see something like that, it's difficult to come away with any other view than that the Americans have a long, long way to go.
All right. Well, Dexter, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dexter Filkins covers Iraq for The New York Times. He's headed back there after a brief respite in sunny Miami. In the southern African nation of Zimbabwe, the regime of President Robert Mugabe continues to tighten the screws on press freedom. The nation's last viable independent paper, The Daily News, was shut down by the government after the nation's high court let stand a Zimbabwe Media Commission decision to refuse the paper a license. This is but one of the administrative barriers set up by Mugabe to legitimize press repression under the rule of law. But the paper's owners continue to use those legal structures to challenge the constitutionality of the restrictions. Joining me now is the Daily News legal representative, Guguletu Moyo. Guguletu, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
In the last few days, the government has taken steps to go after individual journalists for practicing without licenses, which was another procedural obstacle set up by the Mugabe government to restrain free expression. Has it had a chilling effect? Are you going to be unable in the long run to get journalists to write even for the online edition for fear of incarceration or worse?
Yes, I think, you know, the psychological effect of the police action against us is one that we cannot ignore. There quite clearly will be a chilling effect. But we have been talking to our journalists, and they are an extraordinary team of people. You know, they have performed even when we were bombed. Certainly in terms of their legal situation, they're not in the wrong. They did apply, but the commission refused to accredit them. And again, that law requiring journalists to be accredited before they can actually work as journalists is being challenged before the court. It was heard on the 22nd of October last year, and the Supreme Court hasn't handed judgment since then. In the meantime, they are being denied their fundamental right to write and express their views as they wish.
Over the past 2 years, we've spent a lot of time talking to Andrew Meldrum, a correspondent for The Economist, who 3 months ago was expelled from Zimbabwe by the Mugabe regime. I'm curious to know whether the departure of one of the last Western reporters in Zimbabwe has resulted in a lessening of attention to the repressive climate that you're dealing with there.
You know, there's still a substantial body of foreign journalists working here. But I think they also have had to relook their work and what they do in the light of what happened to Andrew Meldrum. Andrew was absolved in a court of law, and still the state felt they didn't like him, and he was evicted. But this has happened to Zimbabweans before. We have a broadcaster known as SW Radio in Zimbabwe, and they won a constitutional application to the Supreme Court. And 6 days after they had won this application, the president signed into law a statute which actually prevented them from continuing to publish. This legislation was signed into law at 3 p.m. At 4 p.m., armed police officers had invaded their offices and evicted them and seized their equipment. So it's almost exactly like the experience that we are going through now. And the whole situation is quite ironic because foreign publications are in a better position than we are. You can buy The Economist here. You can buy a number of South African publications. But I guess it is in the interest of our government to maintain better relations with those nations than with their own people, basically.
And how about you personally, as the legal representative of the Daily News? Clearly you're a thorn in the government's side. Have they made any attempt to intimidate you from proceeding in court as you've been?
What has happened, you know, over the past few weeks is that police officers have gone to my home and looked for me. Before that, about 4 months ago, I was in prison for 3 days. One of our journalists had been detained by the police, and I went down to the police station to actually establish why he was being detained. And when I went down there, the wife of the commander of the armed forces turned up at the police station. You know, she had police officers in the back of her private vehicle. And when they arrived at the police station, they got out and they were assaulting people. You know, I was sitting quietly waiting to see the officer in charge. When I received a phone call, she wanted to know who I was. When I told her that I worked for the Daily News, she decided to assault me. After that, she commanded the police to detain me and also to assault me. And so I was severely assaulted and detained for 3 days without charge. After I was released, I went and reported this incident. They said, well, please give us the address of this person that you're talking about. We have no clue how to find her. This is in spite of the fact that this is a fairly public figure. Now, no arrest has ever taken place since then. What has happened, though, is that I have been charged with inciting them to demonstrate against the sitting government. Now, this is a false charge, totally false. But we believe in what we're doing. We're committed to what we're doing, and we struggle on.
Well, Guguletu, I wish you all the best, and especially for your personal safety. And I look forward to speaking to you again.
Thank you. Bye.
Guguletu Moyo is the legal director of the Daily News, the independent newspaper recently shut down by the government of Zimbabwe.
Up next, a very Washington segment, leaks, spin, and politics, and something even more contentious, your letters.
This is On the Media from NPR. We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the Justice Department said it would investigate the leak of a CIA agent's identity to columnist Robert Novak. That agent is Valerie Plame, the wife of former diplomat Joseph Wilson. Last year, he was sent on a mission to Niger to check out the claim that Iraq had been shopping for weapons-grade uranium. He found no evidence, and when the president repeated the charge in his State of the Union address, Wilson disputed it in the New York Times. In Congress, partisan arguments raged over whether the White House should appoint a special counsel, an action that a recent poll suggests most Americans support. And on Thursday, at least one senior Republican, Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter, said Attorney General John Ashcroft should consider recusing himself from the case. Joshua Marshall, author of the well-known blog TalkingPoints.com, has been following the case and the coverage. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, stories like these that break briefly and then disappear and then come back again in full force are often really proxy stories. They're really about something larger. What's this one about?
Well, I think this story is really quite similar to a number of stories we've seen over the last few months. I think what's happening is that the administration's credibility is slowly being peeled back and eroded over the months. And what's driving that is the failure to find weapons of mass destruction, the increasing sense that there wasn't a clear plan for how to prosecute this war, for how to rebuild the country. So stories that first saw the light of day a few months back, the administration could kind of knock them down by just sort of saying, it's not true, it doesn't matter, or whatever. And the administration was popular enough that it could get away with that. As that credibility gets eroded, the standard for sort of how much evidence is necessary to get a story off the ground keeps going down.
On the other hand, to get these stories back on the front page, there usually needs to be some sort of peg. In the case of the dubious connections between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, there was that poll that suggested 70% of the public thought there were connections, even though there was never any evidence to support that. In this case, what was the triggering event that got it on the front page?
Well, the immediate triggering event was we now know that the CIA, apparently going back 2 months, was informally trying to get the Justice Department to open an investigation. And the Justice Department was basically dragging its feet. Eventually, the CIA, and I think we mean George Tenet, actually, decided to make a formal referral and probably also to leak news of that to the Washington Post. That really forced the Justice Department's hand. They had to make a decision, and there's really only one decision they could make. So once you have that, it's one thing to have a few quotes by Bob Novak and stuff like that and a lot of commentators chattering about it. But once you have the fact that the CIA has said a crime has probably taken place, the Justice Department is moving ahead to find out, those just create facts that reporters can latch onto, and it just escalates from there.
We've been hearing for a long time that there is tension between the CIA and the Pentagon. Would you say that now George Tenet is now entirely off the reservation?
It's a little unclear how much he was the driving force here, but clearly he could have stopped a lot of this stuff. It's been sort of, I guess you might say, a Cold War, as it were, between the White House, the Pentagon, and the CIA. Now it's a hot one. We are now having a lot of ugly stories being churned up by a war between basically the White House, even more specifically the Office of the Vice President, and the CIA that's gone back 2 years. And this new Joe Wilson-Valerie Plame issue is an outgrowth of the uranium stuff. This is all the same story. It's the same people.
Let's talk about how the story is playing out. Obviously, the liberal papers' op-ed pages consider this a very serious story. The Wall Street Journal's op-ed page dismisses it as much ado about nothing and part of a campaign to smear the administration. Any surprises there?
No, but I think in a lot of cases, what makes a scandal a what you might call a stable scandal, where you have, you know, both partisan sides duking it out over it, what you need there is each side to have some arguments that they can make. They don't even have to be good arguments, but each side has to sort of settle on an argument that they can unite around. And I think editorial opinion, even amongst a lot of fairly conservative papers, has certainly not been unambiguously supportive. I mean, I think what it comes down to is what seems to have happened, we don't know yet, but there's a lot of signs that it happened, is that A, laws were broken, but the underlying act was also just a fairly despicable act, and that it was done for fairly petty reasons. It's pretty hard to figure out how to spin that. So what you've seen is people talking about Joe Wilson. He's a bad guy. He's a partisan. The problem is that Wilson, at this point, is fairly irrelevant to what we're talking about. So I think you've seen that kind of go to the wayside.
Do you think the media now have permission that they didn't have before to go after past and present questions raised by the Bush administration? I mean, is it a combination of the polls and stronger denunciations perhaps from Congress or from the Democratic candidates' debates? Do you think all this allows them to go where they weren't bold enough to go before?
I think it's a few things. I think that the further we get from 9/11 is just an important part of it. I think there's two other things. The polls are certainly key. Reporters, unfortunately, do pay a lot of it. I mean, not maybe consciously, but it's always there in the backdrop, how popular the president is. The other thing, and I think this is where the whole uranium flap was, we may look back on that and say that was a pivotal event. credibility and honesty is sort of a unitary thing. You lose it in one place and you kind of lose it everywhere.
And so the damage wrought by the exposure of that bogus Niger deal can't be ameliorated no matter how many undercover agents you leak the names of.
Right, right, right. I mean, I think that this is a product of the damage control from that earlier blow up. And as often happens, the effort to get out in front of these stories leads to further acts that you know, blow up in your face a few months later.
Josh, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joshua Marshall is a contributing writer for The Washington Monthly. He also makes his opinions known daily on the weblog, talkingpointsmemo.com. Now, leaks are part and parcel of the Fourth Estate and have been a tremendous irritant to the Bush administration, especially in the early days of the War on Terror. That was when Bob produced this piece on the pros, cons, and process behind the creation of the ever-present Washington leak.
In the immediate aftermath of September 11th's carnage, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld faced the press to deliver an important message. Not to America, not to the international community, not to the media, but to his own Defense Department. It was a warning about leaking classified information because a leaker, Rumsfeld declared, is a threat.
It's a person who's willing to violate federal criminal statutes and willing to frustrate our efforts to track down and deal with terrorists and willing to reveal information that could cause the lives of men and women in uniform.
2 weeks later, USA Today ran a page one story detailing U.S. Special Forces operations already proceeding on the ground in Afghanistan. 2 weeks after that, President Bush was so infuriated at leaks from Capitol Hill that he tried to cut off classified briefings to all but a few members of Congress.
Some members did not accept that responsibility. Somebody didn't. So I took it upon myself to notify the leadership of the Congress that I intend to protect our troops.
In the end, the president had to back off because by law, the administration must keep Congress fully informed on intelligence matters. To many inside the Beltway, though, it was the president who seemed to be out of the loop. In Washington, leaking is not only business as usual, it's a way of life.
What the president was saying is, I can't believe that people are getting classified briefings and then leaking information. Come on, Mr. President. It's what happens every day.
Scott Armstrong is an investigative reporter, author, and founder of the National Security Archive, a repository of declassified information. He says leakers are not only ubiquitous, but necessary to journalism and democracy.
They're correcting things. Sometimes they're verifying things. This is how we get our information. It's an information economy.
And in the information economy, there is never a recession because there are too many journalists chasing too many bureaucrats and politicians with too many reasons to blab. One who reputedly did not blab was Leon Firth, the vice president's national security advisor in the Clinton administration and someone known for being maddeningly leak-proof. Firth says that was a matter of integrity and discipline. Discipline, however, diminishes geometrically with each additional individual entrusted with a given piece of information.
You have a small meeting. Everybody in that meeting is extremely responsible, and nobody likes leaks of sensitive information. But they all go back from that meeting to their buildings, and they feel obliged to brief at least one or two other people who are very close to them and important to them operationally. And those people, in turn, brief one or two people who are important to them operationally, and pretty soon you have traversed 6 degrees of separation, and the information has crossed the barrier and is in the public domain.
Beyond carelessness, a main category of leaks comes from disaffected insiders, bureaucrats or political appointees wishing to influence debate or expose blunders within their own agencies. And then there's a third variety, the vanity leak.
And that is that somebody has this information and just can't keep quiet about it and wants to talk about it as a way of basically showing off.
Reporters need to understand those various motivations in order to evaluate the substance of a given leak, but mainly they're concerned with the steady flow of reliable information. Bill Gertz is on the national security beat at the Washington Times. So successful has he been in reporting classified information that he was said to be the main target of the so-called official secrets legislation introduced in, but so far unenacted by, Congress.
You know, as we say in the news business, you're only as good as your sources. So we focus quite a bit on being able to circumvent the official public affairs bureaucracy.
If that sounds like a perverse game, that's because it's a perverse game whose perversity is rooted in the fact that official spokesmen mouth the carefully parsed pronouncements of politicians who are worried about political consequences and therefore cannot be relied upon on any subject, including the weather. Even Leon Firth, the Clinton White House's Mr. Tightlips, acknowledges the credibility gap.
Dating back to Vietnam and Watergate, the press has had its reasons to be cynical about the motivations of government in wanting to keep information secret.
Even now, in the enlightened and transparent 21st century, the executive branch tends toward willy-nilly classification of innocuous information that properly belongs in the public domain. And when confronted by media organizations with leaked information for confirmation or comment, official Washington often reacts with reflexive cries of national security. This often leaves media organizations with difficult choices. When asked to kill or alter a story, they have to decide, is it really a matter of protecting military or intelligence personnel in the field, or is the government just trying to shield itself from embarrassment or political fallout? And if the story is held, will it show up the next day in the competition, maybe with a spin favorable to the government? The Washington Times' Bill Gertz.
I can remember in one case we had a story about a CIA officer who was having an affair with an Eastern European intelligence officer, and the CIA had asked that we not publish it, and we didn't. And within a week, the story came out in another news publication.
Some leaks, of course, are well tolerated by administrations because the administration itself, for political or diplomatic reasons, has engineered the leak. Journalist Scott Armstrong.
If you can control the information and you leak it out selectively, you can control the press and you can control the public debate. That's the idea.
Divining what is strategic and what is actually a breach is all part of the game. Not long ago, Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward had an exquisitely detailed story about attempts during the Clinton administration to capture Osama bin Laden. Attempts, according to the Woodward account, that were squelched by Saudi Arabia's refusal to participate. For leakologists, this was an irresistible brain teaser. Was the source old Clintonites, Democrats on the Hill, the Bush White House? Who? Armstrong, who was the co-author with Woodward on the bestseller The Brethren, has his own suspicions. They begin with Saudi diplomat Prince Bandar.
Anyone who's read Woodward's books that deal with the Persian Gulf War would have noted that there are a lot of quote marks around things that Prince Bandar has said. And when somebody tells me that the U.S. wanted to do something with Saudi Arabia, and I know that the principal line of communication throughout the entire period was through Prince Bandar to the Saudi government and back through Prince Bandar to the United States government, I put those two things together and come up with the most likely source of this information is a Saudi.
Leon Firth, for his part, doesn't much care who the source was. Nowadays, he's a visiting professor of international relations at George Washington University, but when he read the piece, his instinct was still to fear for the flock.
Let's say that the information that he reported is correct for the sake of talk, for the sake of discussion. Let's just say that it's correct. Then that would be damaging, because it would talk about, by implication, networks that we used, relationships that we had developed, kinds of influence that we could exercise, and our mode of planning and attack. And I recognize the press has got a problem because there's an infinite requirement for information and for visual images. But the country has a need. Now, is it the government's problem to solve this, or is it the press's problem to figure out how to deal with it?
It's a conundrum, all right. But one answer might be to look elsewhere in the world, where nobody dare leak and nobody dare publish and nobody knows what obscenity the regime is up to next. The citizens' protection is the responsibility of any government. Protection from the national government by a vigilant press and its confederates is a unique blessing of democracy.
And now, some of your letters. Last week, we read a few of your responses to our question on how Middle East coverage could be improved. All the letters we received charged the media with pro-Palestinian bias. But this week, many of you wrote in with the opposite opinion, that the media are biased in favor of Israel. For instance, Jean Higgs wrote in to say that she thinks the balance in the past, it has gotten better in the past year, has been, quote, very pro-Israel. For instance, I have never read that Israelis have over 150 settlements on the West Bank. It is through the BBC I get most of the news, I believe.
And Joel Simpson wrote in from West New York to say he deplores suicide bombings, but also the extrajudicial raids by the Israeli government on Palestinian targets, however heinous those targets are. Innocent deaths are put down as, quote, collateral damage, he writes, and we rarely hear the biographies of these victims the way we do of the Israelis tragically murdered by the suicide bombers. Palestinian suffering and humanity is just not worth as much as Israeli suffering in most of the U.S. press. And finally, this from NPR's Vice President for News and Information, Bruce Drake. He writes, in your letters segment last week on Mideast coverage, listener Percy Dreift said, quote, NPR should name the victims of terrorist attacks in Israel. In fact, NPR has often named the victims of these attacks and did so most recently on September 10th with a profile of two of the victims who had been killed by a bomb the day before. Daniel Stern said NPR should offer historical background because most listeners have no idea what went on the previous five decades. Last year, NPR did a seven-part series covering 100 years of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that won an Overseas Press Club award.
Drake adds that listeners can check these for themselves by going to NPR.org, where Mideast transcripts are posted for free. And while we're on the subject of websites and free transcripts, keep your letters coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
We're going to take a short break for some Starbucks coffee, but when we come back on your Sony radio, we'll tell you about the war on product placement on TV. Also, two entertaining frauds, Laszlo Toth and Stephen Glass.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924. On the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. On the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We're back with On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the mid-90s, Stephen Glass was a writer for The New Republic who also published pieces in Rolling Stone, Harper's, and George. His stories were filled with colorful characters and improbable situations. They were fabulous in every sense of that word. Ultimately, Glass was exposed by his own editor at The New Republic, Charles Lane, and the Forbes writer Adam Pennenberg. They discovered that practically every story Glass wrote was a lie, backed up by bogus notes, websites, phone calls, addresses. Compared to Glass, Jason Blair was a piker. With Lane on his trail, Glass tried desperately to enlist the loyalty of the staff. They were already resentful of Lane, who had taken over as editor after the much-loved Michael Kelly was fired. Glass tried to persuade his friends that Lane intended to push all the Kelly loyalists out. One of those friends was Hannah Rosen, played in the new movie Shattered Glass by Chloe Sevigny, and married in real life to Slate Washington editor David Plotz. David saw the movie and he joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You said in your article that watching the film felt like dreaming, that it was an exact and yet utterly unfamiliar copy of your world. What did you mean?
Well, in Shattered Glass, they've really vividly recreated the world of the New Republic circa, 1998. The actress who plays the character based on my wife looks as much like my wife as a blonde American can look like a brunette Israeli.
We have a clip from the film in which Caitlin Avey, the character that represents your wife, is arguing with editor Charles Lane.
What are you going to do, Chuck? Pick us off one by one? Everybody that was loyal to Mike? Do you have a staff that belongs to you? Is that the kind of magazine you want to run?
Caitlin, when this thing blows, there isn't going to be a magazine anymore.
That actually is one portion of the movie in which it's slightly off base, in the sense that Hannah, the actual person, Hannah Rosen, did defend Steve for quite a while, but didn't defend Steve as far as they have her defend Steve in the movie.
Nevertheless, you and your wife were pretty close with Stephen Glass. He went to your wedding. Did you feel personally let down when the extent of his lies was revealed?
Of course. We were devastated. It was one of these things where once you understood that he had made one thing up, you realized that he had made everything up. And it was this, this sense of wonderment that still persists, which is, was he malevolently, maliciously doing this to us when he would tell us these stories gleefully? Was he doing it to trick us, or was it an effort to make us feel good, to make us feel that we were part of this wonderful world?
But what wonderful world could he involve you in with his lies?
Steve had this very magical quality. He may still have it, which is that you were in a room with him, and he would spin these yarns about things he'd done, which in fact he hadn't done, or people he'd met who in fact were fabrications. But you just felt, wow, the world is strange and wonderful and magical.
Every station on the radio was talking about it. Mike Tyson biting Evander Holyfield. And these were supposed to be news stations. So on Tuesday, I started calling a few of them, and I finally got through to one, a Bible talk station in Kentucky. And I managed to convince the screener that I was a behavioral psychologist who specializes in human-on-human biting. I told the guy that I'd done all this extensive research on people who chomp flesh under extreme stress.
What did they say?
They put me on the air. I took calls for 45 minutes.
And gosh, it really was inspiring. It was, it made us feel bad about our own journalism because our stories didn't have the magic that his stories had. And it was devastating to find out that it was all built on nothing.
David, here's the thing that made me want to talk to you. You said in your article that Shattered Glass is the straightest film take on print journalism that you'd seen since All the President's Men, and that it may become this era's defining movie about journalism. How so?
Well, the middle part of the movie is essentially a procedural about how a journalist goes about doing his work. There's lots of detail about how you fact check. There's detail about how you gather source material. There's detail about checking interviews. Shattered Glass turns all that whole process in which Charles Lane, the editor of the New Republic, and Adam Pennenberg, an editor at Forbes, sort of uncover Steve. It turns that uncovering process into a thriller.
You had your brother pose as George Sims.
What?
The phony recording from Juked Micronics. It's a Palo Alto number. And your brother's a student at Stanford. You had him pose as Sims.
No, Sims is a real guy.
Steve.
I've talked to him a million times, Chuck. My brother and I aren't even speaking right now.
Stop it. You faked Sims. You faked
you don't
the website.
Know.
You faked all
you don't
those
know,
voicemails.
Chuck.
It's all crap. I can trace it if you make me. I'll find it all built in.
I don't know what you're talking about, okay? Those are all real people.
They are.
Yeah.
Look at me. And say that again.
Charles Lane took over as editor after Michael Kelly left, and he's seen as a crusader here, almost iron-jawed. We've heard a lot that Jason Blair and Stephen Glass discredit the profession. In a movie like this, does Charles Lane allow the profession some of its heroes?
The movie makes the Charles Lane character heroic, as Chuck was absolutely heroic. He's almost like a kind of an Old Testament prophet. There's no fun and games to him. He's relentless and he's absolutely right. And you come away thinking, like, it's good to have editors like that. sort of policing the world and making sure that justice is being done.
When you think about how good All the President's Men was for journalism's reputation, how do you think Shattered Glass will fare?
Not so well, obviously. All the President's Men was about taking down a president. This, at its heart, it's about how a callow kid duped a whole lot of people very easily.
And you were one of the dupes.
Yeah, I was one of the dupes. I loved being around him and hearing his stories. And I miss that. And I wish the stories had been true. I still wish that. The world would be a more interesting place if they had been true.
David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
David Plotz is the Washington editor of Slate. Last week, the consumer group Commercial Alert filed petitions with both the FCC and FTC calling for an investigation into the practice of using product placements in TV programs. Embedded advertising is the new reality of television, the petition read, and it is time for the commission to address it. TV networks and stations regularly send programs into American living rooms that are packed with product placements and other veiled commercial pitches, but they pretend that these are just ordinary programming rather than paid ads. This is an affront to basic honesty. The group wants new guidelines that require advertisers to fully disclose when they've paid for placement of their product, both before the program and during the show. So when TV president Jeb Bartlett, relaxing in his quarters, reaches, say, for his Pringles, the word advertisement would flash at the bottom of the screen. Gary Ruskin founded Commercial Alert with Ralph Nader in 1998 and serves as its executive director. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show.
So first off, what's the problem, as you see it, with product placement?
Essentially, infomercials are threatening to swallow television. Basically, there's now embedded advertising of a wide variety of sorts that's increasingly penetrating every nook and cranny of television. We now have product placement, product integration, plot placement, title placement, paid shills, virtual advertising. But television stations aren't disclosing when ads are ads. And so the networks are being totally dishonest by not disclosing that ads are ads. And people are being tricked because they don't know when the ads are ads. And they're zipping under people's consciousness into their heads undisclosed.
You've been very effective at pressing for disclosure on the Internet.
Yeah, essentially, Internet search engines have been trying to put ads into search engine results without disclosing that ads are ads. And 2 years ago, we filed a complaint against a number of search engine companies asking the Federal Trade Commission to require the search engine companies to tell us when ads are ads. And a year ago, the FTC basically agreed with us and did what we asked. And we are making basically the identical argument with respect to product placement on television.
But we've been seeing product placement since the history of television. I mean, since the appearance of GE appliances and Procter & Gamble cosmetics in the soap operas of the 50s. So why now?
Well, it's been a basic principle of American broadcasting law that advertisers and networks have to disclose when ads are ads. And in fact, since the Radio Act of 1927, broadcasters have had to obey the rule that they have to disclose when ads are ads because listeners are entitled to know by whom they're being persuaded. And right now, broadcasters are broadly violating those rules and standards, and it's time for it to stop.
Well, as we've said on this program, new technology is making it a lot easier for viewers just to skip over the commercials altogether. And advertisers say that product placement is really the only survival technique left.
Well, that's not an excuse for violating the law.
Well, can't a case be made that product placement lends a kind of reality to a television program? There's been entire episodes of Seinfeld that have revolved around products, an errant Junior Mint, Jujubes, Drake's Cakes, the Today contraceptive sponge. These lend texture to the programs.
Yeah, there's a difference between product placement that's paid and product placement that's not paid. This is a question of paid product placement, i.e. product placement that's either paid for with money or some other financial consideration.
So you heard that scenario that I laid out in the introduction with the West Wing's president, Jeb Bartlett, reaching for his Pringles. If the TV program went out and bought those Pringles on their own and didn't have them donated, that wouldn't be a problem.
That's correct.
Okay. Gary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gary Ruskin is the director of Commercial Alert, and he was on the line from Portland, Oregon.
30 years ago, an epistolary madman named Laszlo Toth burst onto the scene with the Laszlo Letters, a collection of actual correspondence between a fictional middle American and the real leaders of political and corporate America. Now Laszlo is back with a new collection titled Bush to Bush, documentary evidence that snail mail as a communications medium isn't dead just yet. Joining me now is Laszlo's creator, comedian Don Novello, familiar to many as his other alter ego, Father Guido Sarducci. Don, welcome to the big show.
Nice to be here.
Okay, so you've got this character, a kind of obtuse but extremely energetic super patriot, who is plucked from the core of Nixon's silent majority, and he has lots of ridiculous ideas and a very funny name.
Yes.
But the name is not an invented one. Laszlo Toth was the Australian geologist who took a hammer to Michelangelo's Pieta in St. Peter's in 1972, and while declaring, "I am Jesus Christ."
You know what, though, too? He wore a tuxedo. He wore a tuxedo to attack the Pieta or something else, you know.
Okay, but why Laszlo Toth? Why, of all names to expropriate, did you choose him?
Well, now looking as an overview, it's kind of interesting because he was attacking the establishment in a way, you know. Why I did it to begin with, it was because his name was in the news, you know. But then it just changed, you know, and I made him into this right-wing American.
All right, now the original collection
ridiculed
the America right or wrong sensibility, while at the same time having its way with the man, the big institutions of the political and corporate establishment. But the new collection, which, by the way, is hilarious, seems to pull back from what originally inspired you. Am I imagining that?
You know, I didn't want to stay with that one note, that stand by our flag and that, you know. And so it really changed. The character changed. You know, people look at this and they say, where do you stand? They can't figure out if you're Republican or Democrat. And where I stand was I'm just for the underdog and for the truth, you know. I just see these as, you know, putting out ideas. I saw something, they had this poll, probably Fox, you know, it says, do you think the war is going to last a month or more than a month, you know? 38% said less than a month. 60% said more than a month. 2% said, I don't know. And this was call-in, you know? And I always thought, who's going to call in and say, I don't know? You know? I mean, you know, somebody's saying there, honey, what do you think? He says, I don't know. He said, call in, tell him what you think, you know? I don't know. But the truth is, those are the people out, who does know, you know, if the war is going to last a month or more. It's only what they tell us, you know? So I'm for the I don't knows, and I think whenever they take these polls, say I don't know, you know, and together we'll become the I don't know majority, you know.
Before we go any farther, for the uninitiated, would you please read one of your favorite letters?
You know, I'd love to read the letter to the Queen Mom.
God rest her soul.
Yeah, God rest her soul, yeah. Queen Mother, 100 years old, and they had this big party, and it was in People magazine pictures. And I wrote to her, I said, dear Queen Mom, I have this to say, of all the people at the party, from the pictures, you look like you were having the most merry old time of everybody. I'll bet there's one title nobody ever gave you, designated driver, am I right? I learned a long time ago that gin is not a summertime drink. Have you ever tried abstinence? That's what Toulouse-Lautrec used to drink. You probably knew him, that's why I mention it.
You mentioned that Laszlo is an idea man, and he is, and some of them are really stupid ideas.
Yeah.
Tell me about the interspecies TV dinners.
You know, that's kind of a stupid idea. Well, you know, if you're like me, you know, you have a cat, and you feed the cat, the dog eats it, you know, because cats eat slow. The dog eats real fast. You're eating, he wants more of yours. And this is a TV dinner that contains all three entrees for the three different species, and you eat together.
And who did you send that idea to?
To Swanson's, to their Salisbury steak dinner team.
What was the response from Swanson to your idea?
They don't consider ideas from outside sources. You know, sometimes they write back and they say, like, we've already thought of this. That's what I wanted, you know, from them. But
so is this it for Laszlo?
Yeah, I've done it 30 years. I think that's enough. You know, I've written to five U.S. presidents. No, five presidents of McDonald's and seven U.S. presidents. I also wrote to Donald Rumsfeld. I gave him some ideas. I said, hey, here's some ideas for you. at your next press conference. You know, he always answers his own questions, you know. Mm-hmm. Here's what I said. He used to say, has Osama and other top Talibans managed to sneak over the border to Pakistan? It's possible. There must be 50 ways to leave Afghanistan. Hop on a mule, Abdul. Dress as a maiden, Bin Laden. Have your wives pull you in a sled, Ahmed. Give the border guards moolah. Well, Don Rumsfeld never wrote back, but I know he meant to. But General Myers did, you know, and I wrote him. I said, my dentist is from Afghanistan, and he has relatives there, and his aunt wrote him that one of the good things about the war is that meat is much more plentiful. And she wanted to know, is it okay to eat goats that have been killed by missiles or bombs? And he wrote back, General Myers, and he talked about the how the food shortage is getting better. He didn't talk about the goats specifically.
Well, Don Novello, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Don Novello is the alter ego of Laszlo Toth. The latest collection of the Laszlo Toth letters is called From Bush to Bush and has just hit the bookstore shelves.
50 ways to leave your lover. You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. Just get yourself free. Or hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just jump off the key, Lee, and get yourself free. Ooh, slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. You just listen to me. Or hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key and get yourself free.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Janine Price, Katya Rogers, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen. And edited by Brooke. We had help from Dave Goldberg. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer and Dean Capello our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John D. and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.